Welcome to the show. Unless you've been living in a cave, you likely know former President Donald Trump was convicted of 34 felonies in a New York State court on May 30th, 2024. Some folks are thrilled with the outcome, and others are more than a little displeased. Those who are unhappy with the outcome have a lot to say about it. One of their claims is that the various prosecutions against Trump are solely political and designed to stop him from becoming president again. Is that true? Let's examine the facts, and you be the judge.
The Dr. Reality Vodcast with Dave Champion.
Let's start with this. Today, we're going to focus on four criminal cases against Trump. The New York case that was just concluded with guilty verdicts on 34 counts, and three pending cases. The pending cases are the classified documents case in a federal court in Florida, the election interference case in a federal court in Washington, D.C., and the RICO case in a Georgia state court. The question we're exploring today is whether those four cases are politically motivated or were brought under the same standards used for any other criminal prosecution. Before we jump in, try your best to keep a couple of things in mind. First, if you dislike Trump, that does not mean he should be prosecuted in circumstances where other people would not. Second, if you adore Trump, you should not want him to avoid being prosecuted if he has committed crimes. A person holding either of those positions would be an un-American piece of shit. So I'm sure you don't hold those views. Before we look at the particulars of the cases involving Trump, we need to understand the duties of a prosecutor. At its core, a prosecutor's job is to seek justice by using the courts to hold accountable those believed to have violated criminal statutes enacted by the elected representatives of we the people. In other words, we the people elect people to represent us in the legislature. As our representatives, legislators enact statutes that define what actions are crimes. When the media or private persons bring evidence to a prosecutor's attention that rises to the level of reasonable suspicion a crime has been committed, the prosecutor will investigate to see if there is sufficient evidence leading to probable cause and, ultimately, whether there is sufficient evidence to convince a jury of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Investigating allegations when evidence is laid before a prosecutor showing a likelihood a crime was committed is quite literally what residents of that jurisdiction pay the prosecutor to do. When a prosecutor investigates, he or she is looking for evidence that indicates a crime was committed or not. If the investigation shows there was no violation of a criminal statute or the available evidence is insufficient to convince a jury of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the prosecutor drops the matter. On the other hand, if the evidence indicates a violation of a criminal statute has occurred and the evidence is sufficient to convince a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, the prosecutor has a duty to file charges and prosecute the defendant. Again, that's what the community pays prosecutors to do. When the evidence is there, it is the prosecutor's job to prosecute, even if he or she isn't particularly keen on the statute that was violated. If the evidence is there, it is the prosecutor's job to prosecute, even if you are not keen on the statute that was violated. For a prosecutor to know that a violation of criminal statutes or statutes has occurred and not prosecute the violator is a dereliction of duty. But what about prosecutorial discretion? Can't prosecutors use their own judgment about filing charges? To an extent, yes. The most common example of prosecutorial discretion is plea bargains where the defendant agrees to plead guilty to a lesser charge and the prosecutor's office avoids the time and expense of a trial. The more serious the crime and the more evidence the prosecutor has, the less likely it is the prosecutor will agree to a plea deal, or at least a deal the defendant will consider favorable. With that information under our belts, let's get into the meat of the issue, which is how these investigations into Trump began, and do the facts indicate political chicanery or the prosecutor's duty-bound to investigate? We'll begin with the New York State case, the one in which the jury recently found Trump guilty of 34 felonies. How did that case develop? You're likely aware of Michael Cohen, an attorney, now former attorney, who was a Trump Organization vice president for a decade and Trump's fixer. When Trump and Cohen had their falling out, Cohen started making public statements about crimes committed by Trump. Cohen claimed to have personal knowledge of these crimes and publicly stated he could lead prosecutors to all the evidence they'd need to make a case and convict Trump of the crimes Cohen was alleging. Day after day, New York prosecutors were waking up to news stories about Cohen's claims concerning Trump. At the same time, Cohen's attorney was meeting with prosecutors, telling them his client had firsthand knowledge of crimes committed by Trump and was prepared to give prosecutors a roadmap by which to obtain all the evidence they'd need to convince the jury of Trump's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Keep in mind, it wasn't just Cohen alleging Trump had committed crimes. Cohen was offering to direct prosecutors to a trove of evidence that would independently verify Cohen's claims. Cohen's attorney was telling New York prosecutors that Cohen had enough evidence to establish probable cause, which is required for search warrants, and if prosecutors used search warrants to get information from sources indicated by Cohen, prosecutors would obtain all the evidence they need to convince a jury of Trump's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And all of this was being done in a very public manner. Knowing what you now know about the duty of prosecutors, can you think of any scenario in which New York State prosecutors could have avoided opening an investigation into Cohen's claims? Remember, the question we're exploring today is whether these prosecutions are political rather than legally proper and appropriate. If you're even halfway rational, you'll have to admit there was no political chicanery in the decision to initiate the New York investigation. Cohen and his attorney made it so New York prosecutors had to open an investigation. To not do so would have been an egregious case of dereliction of duty. But what if there was little convincing necessary? What if New York State prosecutors were more than happy to open an investigation into Trump? Hell, what if they were giddy at the prospect? So what? Whether they were not thrilled about opening an investigation, or downright gleeful about it, Cohen and his attorney removed the prosecutor's discretion. Cohen and his attorney created a situation in a very public way that required prosecutors to open an investigation into the allegations, no matter how they felt about it. As it turned out, Cohen was right. He was instrumental in directing New York prosecutors to most of the evidence presented at trial that resulted in Trump's conviction. Let's switch gears and talk about the classified documents case. This one is pretty straightforward. The National Records and Archives Administration, NARA, believed Trump had moved presidential records belonging to the United States government from the White House to Mar-a-Lago. NARA reached out to Trump and requested records belonging to the United States be returned. 8 months later, Trump sent NARA 15 boxes of documents. When NARA began cataloging the contents, they found classified documents. NARA correctly determined that unlawful possession of classified documents falls within the jurisdiction of the U.S. Department of Justice's National Security Division. NARA contacted the National Security Division and told them what had occurred. The first thing the National Security Division did was to determine if Trump had submitted the necessary paperwork seeking approval to be in possession of classified documents since he was no longer president. They found he had not. With that finding, Trump's possession of classified documents was determined to be illegal as a matter of law. At that point, the National Security Division quite correctly opened an investigation to determine if Trump possessed additional classified documents. And, of course, it turned out the facts were far worse than what the National Security Division knew at that time. In June 2023, I posted a video detailing the facts that led to Trump's indictment in this particular matter. I'll put the link down in the notes. For the purpose of this presentation, the important takeaway from the series of events we just discussed is that just like the New York State prosecutors, the attorneys at DOJ's National Security Division were duty-bound to open an investigation. That is literally what they are paid to do. And there is zero evidence the National Security Division opened its investigation based on any political overtones or was driven by anything other than the division's attorneys doing their job properly and professionally. The last two cases are the Georgia State RICO case and the federal election interference case in DC. I'm going to discuss them together because they both rely on essentially the same set of facts. To understand how these investigations came to be, we need to consider the primary charges and then examine how these charges arose. In the DC case, the primary charge is conspiracy to defraud the United States, which can be found in Title 18 of the United States Code at Section 371. To make the case that Trump committed fraud, the government must show that his actions were intended to corruptly pursue personal gain by making statements he knew or had reason to know were not factual. In plain English, a fraud charge alleges the person knew he was lying and did so at the expense of others. Others in this case would be the voters in the 2020 election. So what evidence does the government possess indicating Trump knew or should have known he was lying when he said he lost the 2020 election due to election fraud? Before I answer that, let me mention that the government has considerably more evidence than what is in the indictment and what the public knows at this time. Today, we're examining only the evidence currently available. The government's evidence begins with these points. In interviews with government investigators, Matt Oskowski, hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly, stated that as the ballots were counted, he told Trump he had lost the election. So who is Matt Oskowski? Matt is an expert in data strategy, research, and predictive modeling programs. He was employed by Trump and was a key player in Trump's 2020 campaign organization. Trump's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, strongly cautioned Trump against claiming he won the election or trying to invalidate the results. The U.S. Department of Justice, under Trump's Attorney General, Bill Barr, found no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the election. The upshot of those facts was that Trump was told by his lead data analyst that he'd lost. He was told by his White House counsel he'd lost. And the DOJ, helmed by his own appointee, reported to him no evidence existed of election fraud that would alter the outcome of the election. Despite those facts being presented to Trump, he continued to promote the narrative that the election was stolen due to election fraud. But simply saying something false doesn't necessarily mean a person is committing fraud. In many cases, fraud involves actions that accompany the words. And that brings us to the next element of the government's allegations, which is that Trump conspired with others to corruptly interfere with the outcome of the 2020 election. Chief among those with whom the government alleges Trump conspired are Trump attorneys John Eastman and Kenneth Chesbrough. Chesbrough is considered the architect of the plan to create fake electors. Eastman is considered the architect of the plan to have Vice President Pence refuse to read the electoral counts before Congress, thus, according to Eastman, preventing Joe Biden from becoming president. Both Eastman and Chesbrough have been indicted in several jurisdictions for crimes associated with attempting to unlawfully alter the outcome of the 2020 election. Understanding what the primary charge is against Trump in the D.C. case, what caused the U.S. Department of Justice and various state attorneys general to open investigations that eventually led to indictments? No matter your thoughts about the events of January 6, I'm confident you can understand why the Justice Department opened an investigation into the events of that day. One aspect investigators would seek to determine is how did January 6th occur? Was it merely a spontaneous occurrence, or was there an intentional effort to cause it to occur? Remember, this presentation isn't about the indictments or Trump's guilt or innocence, but rather seeks to determine whether the investigations were opened because of some nefarious anti-Trump agenda. Clearly, DOJ opening an investigation into the events of January 6th was completely proper and appropriate. With the origins of the DC investigation now understood, let's consider how the fourth and final investigation began. The Georgia investigation began after Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, went public with a recording of Trump asking Raffensperger to alter Georgia's official vote count. You may remember Trump's statement that he wanted Raffensperger to, quote, find 11,780 votes, close quote. I think a lot of people are unclear about how Trump's request was seen by the state's prosecutors. Trump didn't ask Raffensperger to conduct a recount and see if anything changed. Trump asked Raffensperger to find a very specific number of votes, 11,780. So, what is the significance of that number? 11,780 votes would have resulted in Trump winning the state of Georgia by a single vote. I think it would be difficult for a rational person to interpret Trump using that specific number as anything other than he was asking Raffensperger to do whatever it took to declare Trump the winner. Also, Trump used the word find an additional 11,780 votes. Keep in mind that elections are controlled by law. Since there's no magical way to just find votes a disgruntled candidate didn't get, Trump's request to find them could perhaps reasonably be interpreted as suggesting Raffensperger used means outside the law. Trump's ask also has to be placed within the context that during the phone conversation, Raffensperger told Trump there was no significant election fraud in Georgia's voting, and certainly nothing that would come within shouting distance of 11,780 votes. We also need to consider, as a prosecutor would, that Raffensperger had intimate knowledge of how voting took place in Georgia, and Trump did not. I will remind you that Trump's DOJ found no evidence of any widespread election fraud, and while Trump repeatedly told Raffensperger election fraud had been rampant in Georgia's voting, he didn't offer a shred of evidence to support that. Let's focus on evidence for a moment. Trump, Giuliani, and Eastman all called Rusty Bowers, Republican Speaker of the Arizona House of Representatives, asking him to look into claims of fraud. Bowers declined to do so without evidence that election fraud had occurred. In other words, Bowers didn't say no. He said he'd do it if they could provide evidence of election fraud. None of the three, Trump, Giuliani, or Eastman, were able to provide Bowers with a shred of evidence, just as Trump had been unable to provide evidence to Raffensperger. Let's recap what we have covered so far in terms of Georgia. The investigation began because Raffensperger went public with Trump asking him to do something that sounded at best unethical and at worst illegal. With that recording being made public, Georgia prosecutors had no choice but to investigate. But remember, an investigation can find evidence of a crime or evidence that no crime occurred. Of course, at that same time, the press was filled with articles about attempts Trump and company were making to get other officials in other states to change their official vote tally. Given the similarity of what Trump and his people were asking for in those jurisdictions, it would have been standard operating procedures for Georgia investigators to reach out to the officials and investigators in those states to see where evidence in those cases was leading. Those inquiries began to reveal the fake elector plot and eventually led to the RICO charges. A couple of quick notes to add context. Four of the 19 defendants indicted in Georgia's RICO case have already pled guilty and promised to testify truthfully at trial. Three of the four are former Trump attorneys. In the D.C. election interference case, there are six unnamed co-conspirators. News agencies have put together the pieces and have identified five of the six. Those five are Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Kenneth Chesbro, Sidney Powell, and Jeffrey Clark. Not only are all five attorneys who had been working with Trump, but they are unnamed co-conspirators because each has cut a deal to testify truthfully at Trump's trial in exchange for not being prosecuted in this particular federal case, though they are being prosecuted criminally in other jurisdictions. The sixth person is a political consultant who exchanged not being indicted for the names of those involved in the fake elector plots in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The consultant's name is not known to the public at this time. I share this to make the point that this is how investigations work. As investigators identify crimes that have been committed, they will sometimes offer immunity to those who can further the investigation or whose testimony might convince a jury of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which, as we discussed earlier, is the goal of prosecutors once evidence tells them crimes have been committed. So now we've looked at all four investigations that eventually resulted in criminal indictments. Were any of them initiated because of politics or political pressure? I leave you to determine that, but speaking for myself, the answer is no. Each was initiated because prosecutors became aware of information that required them to open an investigation. The communities they serve literally pay them to do that. In my opinion, we make better decisions and see the world more clearly when we know the facts and understand how certain specialized fields work. I hope today you gained a better understanding of how prosecutors work, including why they are duty-bound to open an investigation in certain circumstances. While we're on the subject of seeing the world more clearly when we know the facts and understand how certain specialized fields work, I want to encourage you to read Income Tax Shattering the Myth, the best-selling book in America that tells the truth about upon whom Congress has imposed the income tax and upon whom it has not. As you might imagine, income tax is a highly specialized field. The near total ignorance of the American people regarding this specialized field is how the U.S. government has bamboozled hundreds of millions of Americans into believing they owe the government a percentage of the money they earn to sustain themselves and their families. Knowing what the law says, I haven't filed a return or paid a penny of income tax in 31 years. Tens of thousands of Americans have left the income tax scam behind after reading Income Tax Shattering the Myth. While income tax is a specialized field, I wrote Income Tax Shattering the Myth in such a way as to allow every American to understand what has really been taxed. And it's not your labor. I'm about to make a statement with which every one of the tens of thousands of readers of Income Tax Shattering the Myth will agree. That statement is this: when you complete Income Tax Shattering the Myth, you will be the expert in the room. And it doesn't matter who's in the room. Even if there are tax attorneys there, you will be the expert. Imagine going from being completely ignorant about a specialized area of law to being the expert in the room merely by reading a single book. Income Tax Shattering the Myth creates that transformation in you. As if that isn't amazing enough, Income Tax Shattering the Myth gives you the facts, the knowledge, to safely walk away from the government's income tax scam if you'd prefer to keep 100% of your earnings rather than give a chunk of it to the government based on nothing more than 60 years of propaganda and disinformation. You can get your copy of Income Tax Shattering the Myth at drreality.news, drreality.news. While you're there, take a look at body science. If you want the same kind of evidence-based breakdown as you've seen today, but focused on how your body's physiology really works, rather than the false establishment narrative that Americans have been fed for the last 60 years, while you're purchasing Income Tax Shattering the Myth, also pick up a copy of Body Science. You may have noticed that the health of the American people is terrible and getting worse every day. 70% of our population is overweight or obese. Diseases like diabetes and Alzheimer's are exploding. Obesity in children, which was almost unknown a few decades ago, is now commonplace. Due to trillion-dollar industries pouring money into corrupt research, fake science is everywhere these days. Supposedly, scientific studies are making nonsensical claims, such as things like salt or eating red meat cause type 2 diabetes. Why is America's health in such a tragic state? Because certain industries and the U.S. government have engaged in massive disinformation that has led to the American people into illnesses simply to increase revenues. Body science shows you the disinformation. What will likely shock you is that almost everything you now believe about health and physiology is inaccurate. But it's not your fault. You've been bombarded with lies for 60 years. Those lies led the people of the wealthiest and most technologically advanced nation on Earth to be the sickest people in all of human history. If you read Body Science and put into action what you find there, you will leave the ranks of the misled and become astoundingly healthy. You have my word on that. I practice what I preach. I adhere to everything in Body Science, and at 64, I'm as healthy as an 18-year-old. Body Science has never gotten anything less than a 5-star review, and readers rave about the fact that they look and feel decades younger after putting into action what they learn in Body Science. So go to drreality.news, drreality.news, and change your life for the better by getting Income Tax Shattering the Myth and Body Science. Also, by purchasing Income Tax Shattering the Myth and or Body Science, you help me to continue to be here for you with these revealing and thought-provoking presentations. Please share this presentation everywhere. Thanks for being here. Take care.